D-E-N-N-I-S. Translation. Fuck you, Dennis. Because it gets very personal, this kind of long-term, close-range war. These guys all know each other. No, they don't actually know each other, but they know each other. The Sanchez family probably does as much intelligence on the DEA as the DEA does on them. They know where the others live, where they eat, who they see, who they fuck, how they work. They know their families, their friends, their enemies, their tastes, their quirks, their dreams, their fears. So leaving a message in human entrails is almost a grisly joke between rivals. But it's also a statement of relative power, like, look what we can do on our turf that you can't do on yours. Dennis started his career as a uniformed cop in Buffalo. One morning, in a frigid pre-dawn, wind coming off the lake like the swing of a killing sword, he saw an old carpet leaning at an odd angle against an alley wall. The carpet turned out to contain the frozen corpse of a coke whore, and pressed against her cold chest was her frozen baby, blue in death. He volunteered for the narco squad the next day. Weeks later, he went on his first undercover and busted the dealers, took night classes, got his degree, and applied to DEA. Happiest day of his life when he got accepted, although he will say it was his wedding day, and later, the days his children were born. Undercovers are great liars. Their lives depend on it. DEA threw him right back undercover. Upstate New York, then Jersey, then the city. He was a star, a real stud monkey, making cases that the federal prosecutors loved. Then they jerked him up from under and sent him down to Colombia, then Mexico. Sandy-haired, boyish grin, Huck Finn with an East Coast mouth and a killer's heart. The targets loved him, fell all over themselves to sell him dope and put themselves in the shit. Undercovers are great con men. Their jobs depend on it. A star now, he was moved to the front line of the war on drugs, the 2,000-mile border with Mexico. They even gave him a choice of assignments, El Paso or San Diego. Let me think. El Paso or San Diego? El Paso or San Diego? El Passhole or Sundog? Sorry, Tex, no offense, pard, but come on. So Dennis Kane set up shop in the backyard of the Baja Cartel, just across the fence, literally, from the Sanchez family business. And no one's inviting the neighbors over for a cookout. It's just war, day in, day out. You want to talk about the war on drugs? Of course, it should be the war against drugs, the ambiguity of the on having caused some spectacular HR problems at DEA, and Chan would tell you about a lot of guys who fought their war on drugs. This is no man's land, all unquiet on the Western Front. Dennis and cohorts bust a shipment, the Sanchezes kill a snitch. Dennis and company find a tunnel under the border, the Sanchezes are already digging a new one. Dennis busts a cartel leader, another Sanchez steps into the gap to replace him. The drugs and the money keep on turning, proud marijuana keeps on burning. Now Dennis looks down at the eviscerated bodies of three men, one of whom was his snitch, and the calling card arranged with their intestines. What? He says. They ran out of spray paint. Lado shrugs. 66. O blurts out, I want to meet my bio father. All Paku would tell O, despite her persistent questioning when she was 7 or 8, was that her father was a loser and therefore better out of her life. O learned not to bring it up. Now she does. To Ben. Ben's a little stunned. And more than a little distracted with converting his subversive plan into subversive action. But Ben is Ben. What do you hope to achieve? By meeting the sperm donor? That's what we're talking about, right? O lists the potential benefits. 1. Lay a guilt trip on someone else for a change. 2. Piss Paku off. 3. freak people out by performing hideously inappropriate PDA. 4. Piss Paku off. 5. Pretend he's actually her sugar daddy. 6. Piss, go back to 5, Ben says. You're on to something there. What do you mean? Come on, Ben says. Paku is turning off the tap, so you're looking for a new tap. That's deeply cynical, Ben. Okay. A poor little rich girl just wants some paternal love, she says. And you attribute her motivations to a crass, goal-digging campaign instead of the profound search for identity that... Do you even know where he is? I know his name. 67. She was looting an absent Paku's dresser drawers for cash and found something even better. A vibrator. What she would refer to as Paku's smartest boyfriend. The bestest stepdad ever. Uberman, with apologies to Chan's beloved Nietzsche. BNI, batteries not included. No first dates, no awkward conversations, no futile fumbling, no messy human relationships. Just fire that bad boy up, find a suitable fantasy, and the big O, or O's, plural, if you do it right. However, right next to the rabbit, she found something else. Her birth certificate, with the name of the father she'd never met, Paul Patterson. Her father's identity, sitting next to a plastic phallus. 3 months in therapy, right there. 68. I mean, I could track him down, couldn't I? O asks Ben. Maybe, Ben says. But then what? He worries she has this fantasy. She's going to meet her dad. He's going to be great. They're going to have this relationship. I don't know. Ask him questions? Ben knows that she already has the answers in her head. Her father always wanted to be with her. Paku is the evil stepmother who forced him away. Like, why he left before you were born? Ben asks. Like, if he loves you? What's he gonna say, O, that's gonna make your life any better? She has the obvious riposte. What's he going to say to make my life any worse? 69. Dennis has a beautiful wife, 2 beautiful daughters, and a beautiful if modest home in a nice suburb of San Diego, where the neighbors grill steaks and salmon and invite each other over from across the fence. He goes to church on Sundays, one of those nice, tame establishment churches that believes in God and Jesus, but not so much that it's inconvenient, and comes home and catches the afternoon football game, or maybe goes for a walk with the family on the beach. He has the sweet life and knows it. Career going great. You get good headlines for the guys who sign your annual reviews. You put them between a bunch of cameras and bales of marijuana. You let them pose beside mugshots of Mexican cartel figures. Autopsy photos even better. Your life plan is looking pretty solid. It's not cynical. This you must understand. You have to get this, or none of it makes sense or has any meaning. Dennis does work that he loves and believes in, scrubbing the scourge of drugs from the American landscape. He believes. So where does it start? You could say it starts that morning, as Dennis stands in front of the mirror shaving and feels that discomforting little tingle of undefined discontent. But maybe, the whole concept of omniscient narration is pretty fucked anyway, right? It doesn't. Maybe it starts the night before, with the discussion of the granite countertops. They're remodeling the kitchen, and his wife really wants granite countertops. But when you look at the prices in the catalogs, it's like, holy shit. Maybe it starts because his work is the kind of thing he wants to talk about at home on Thursday pizza night, when Domino's delivers and his oldest girl is already seriously into the Idol results show. When his wife asks the, how was your day, question, he answers, fine. And that's it. And that wears him down. Isolates him from the people he loves the most. Maybe it's the cumulative effect of that, or maybe it's a baby, frozen blue, in a dark gray dawn 20-something years ago, in a war that never seems to end. 70. Chan's face appears on the screen via the miracle of Skype. Ben angles the lappy so O can see him too. She breaks into a huge grin. Chani, 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 Chani boy!
Hi, guys.
How are you, bro? Ben asks.
Good. Yeah, fine. You?
Excellent, Ben lies. Wants to tell him. Can't. Even when Chan asks,
How's business?
Business is good. Because it seems cruel to tell someone about a problem he can't do anything about but sit and worry. And the last thing Ben wants to give Chan is a distraction. Take his mind off what he's doing. And Chan looks tired. Worn down. So Ben commits a lie of omission. So instead they make small talk. O assures Chan that she's taking good care of his plant. And then Chan's time is up, and his face disappears from the screen. 71. Ben's lying. Chan could see it on his face. Something's wrong at home. Something with the business. But he pushes the thought aside to focus on the mission. The mission is simple. He's done it a few dozen times now. Night raids on a house. Chan's team isn't involved with complicated counterinsurgency operations, gaining the trust of the people, setting up village security, building clinics, clean water systems, schools, winning hearts and minds. Chan's team does anti-terrorist ops, degrade and disrupt the enemy's command and control systems. Put simply, find enemy leaders and kill them. The theory being that dead people are probably degraded but definitely disrupted, death being more or less the maximum kink in someone's day. The collateral theory being that if you kill enough leaders, it discourages middle management from applying for the job vacancy. Nobody wants that promotion. More money, more responsibility, corner office, laser dot. Most Salafist leaders want to go to paradise eventually, not immediately, generously yielding that privilege to lesser beings. Otherwise, that cocksucker bin Laden would be standing on the top of the Sears Tower waving his arms like, come and get me, not hiding out. Anyway, over the course of a couple of wars, Chan's unit morphed from counterinsurgency to anti-terrorism because the latter is cheaper, faster, and easier to tabulate. Bodies, especially dead ones, being easier to count than hearts, fickle, and minds, transitory. So he's used to missions like this. There's just so goddamn many of them. So many bad guys to kill. 72. Dennis has put bad guys away to see other bad guys take their places. Dennis has looked into the dead, tortured faces of his sources. Dennis has seen, you've heard the expression truckloads of cash? And thought it was a figure of speech? Dennis has seen, literally, truckloads of cash headed south for Mexico to people who have kitchens with granite countertops. And he turns those trucks into his bosses, who pose beside them while he dutifully puts a little money away each month for his kids' college educations. And his wife clips coupons because while paradise is also expensive. Dennis sees his face get a little older, hair a little thinner, belly no longer taut, knows that his reflexes are a little slower, memory not quite as acute, that there might be more calendar pages behind than in front of him. So maybe that little nudge of discontent was fear. Maybe not. Maybe it was just discontent, as in the winter of, in a place that knows no real winter. Anyway, you need to know that Dennis hoards information. He feels justified in doing so because he's worked hard to develop sources. They're his, and he doesn't share them because he doesn't want to share the information they develop. This does not make Dennis particularly popular among his peers, but he doesn't give a shit. The life plan isn't to make friends among his peers, it's to rise above them, and then they're not going to like him anyway. So Dennis's modus operandi is to work his sources to develop information right up to the point of making a bust, then dole those busts out for the best possible political and promotion-creating effect. That's why when one of his CIs, that's confidential informants, and D has given a whole new meaning to the confidential, tells him about this isolated little ranch house way the fuck out in East County near Hamul, he goes by himself. The Lone Ranger, or the Lone Stranger, as he's known in the office. Undercovers are natural loners. They don't trust anybody. Paranoia is a survival strategy. Sans tanto, as Paku might say, recalling that she's in her French phase, to check it out. Solo surveillance. Dennis has balls, big, clanging brass, so he drives out into the dark desert all by his lonesome. Parks his vehicle on a ridge overlooking this ranch and trains his night scope on the house. It's a cash dump. There's a phrase, huh? What's happening is that the dealers are bringing their cash there to be counted, sorted, and stacked for the relatively short dash down across the border. On any given night, there's going to be hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars in that house. Dennis takes one look at this and knows that it's the bust that could put him over. Because what he also sees through that scope is Filippo Sanchez, number 3 in the Baja Cartel. 73. The night is eerie green through Chan's night goggles. Monster movie green. He rolls out of the APC, armored personnel carrier, behind his team, and rushes toward the compound of two-story concrete buildings where the CIA boys said the AQ honchos are holed up. Pressing the butt of the M14 rifle to his shoulder, he keeps it at firing position as the C4 charges blow the gate off its hinges and the team goes in. Chan has a photo of the AQ asshole that is target number 1 burned into his memory pan. Mahmoud El-Kassani. Where are you, Mahmoud? 74. Dennis knows Filippo. Hell yes, he does. He has Filippo's picture pinned up on the bulletin board in his office. He knows the names of Filippo's wife and kids, knows what football team he follows, knows that Filippo subscribes to the Padres games on satellite TV. This must be an important cash dump for Filippo to chance coming over the wire, so he must be up there checking up on things, making sure that all of the money goes south and none of it gets lost and wanders toward other points on the compass. While Dennis would normally keep this house under surveillance for a couple of weeks and then turn it over to his superiors so they could get the credit, now he's thinking about playing leapfrog. The San Diego sack is looking at retirement, and a pop like this could put Dennis's ass into his empty chair. So this is totally a cowboy move, highly discouraged by the powers that be, but Dennis knows that he has a justification. He can always say that he had to take the chance. Who knew when and if Filippo would ever come back, be on this side of the border? And there's a federal trafficking warrant on the guy anyway, so... He clips his badge onto his jacket, finds his DEA cap in the back seat, pulls his weapon, and goes in. 75. Chaos in the compound, foxes in the henhouse. As women shriek, children scream, goats bleat. No chaos for the team. They know exactly where they are and where they're going, up some stairs to the second floor. Bullets zip past them as the AQ fight back. Chan moves the rifle around smoothly. Target, shoot. Target, shoot. Target, shoot. He makes it to the door and heads up the stairs. One of the AQ shot out the light bulbs at the sound of the explosion, and it's black and tight in there. Chan feels someone come out of a doorway beside him, and he swings the rifle to take him out and sees... It's a kid. Can't be 12, in the traditional vest, the waskath, from which Chan knows we got the word waistcoat. And skullcap, big black eyes. Shoot every male is the order. But Chan isn't going to follow that order, so he shoves the kid back in the room and moves up the stairs into a room that becomes a charnel house. As the team shoots everyone inside, and Chan sees Mahmoud, who doesn't want to become a martyr this night. He puts his hands up to surrender. Chan drills him twice through the chest because Chan wants him to be a martyr. Paradise is paradise, but it's also expensive. 76. Yeah, they might try to slug it out with him, in which case he's dead. More likely, they're just going to bolt, in which case most of them will make it. But it's worth the risk. Nailing Filippo Sanchez? Come on. So Dennis charges down there in his Jeep like a movie cowboy on his horse. There's no fence, no gate, because the narcos don't want to call attention to the house, and Dennis just drives right up, slams the brakes and jumps out, badge in one hand, pistol in the other, and announces, DEA, this is a raid, nobody fucking move. Dennis has balls. Three gunmen are just standing there, open-mouthed, staring at him, clearly trying to figure out what to do. And this is the moment when, if they were going to shoot him, they would. In the Jerry Bruckheimer version, they do just that. They whip out the weaponry and let fly, missing almost every shot, while Dennis guns them all down and, hit in the shoulder, bursts into the house and has a shootout with Filippo. Roll credits, sweep up the popcorn. Except a multi-billion-dollar polydrug cartel doesn't get to be a multi-billion-dollar polydrug cartel because they have a lot of stupid people working for them. And while this isn't your typical DEA raid with the typical cast of characters, it's still a DEA raid. And these guys know that killing a federal agent on American soil is going to cost a lot more money in the long run than is in the house. Subjects them to the needle instead of 15 to 30, and even Filippo Sanchez is expendable. That's just the truth. That's just life in the vida narco. Money is just money. They lose it all the time. Same with people. They go to jail. They come out. It's the chance you take. That even applies to Filippo. Royal family or no royal family. It happens, and the family goes on. So what happens is they do freeze, and Dennis strides right past them into the house, where Filippo Sanchez looks up from a folding table stacked with cash and looks mildly surprised, and calmly says, "There's $550,000 on this table for you if I go out that door." 77. Back down the stairs now. Mission accomplished. Everyone gets to go home, drink a beer, watch a DVD. Women are already mourning, keening, ululating, but Chan no longer hears that. White noise. He's almost down the stairs when the kid steps out again. Chan sees the kid's innocent black eyes and says, "Oh, fuck," as the kid reaches inside the waskath and detonates the bomb strapped to his body. The green world goes red. 78. Few people ever have to find out what they would do when their whole life has been based on one thing, and then they're offered the other. Dennis knows that he can bust Filippo, and five other Filippos will kill each other trying to take the job vacancy. Knows that the job vacancy will be filled, because the money is just too good. Knows he should bust him anyway, cuff him and read him his rights. Filippo is showing no signs that he's going to resist or run. Maybe if Filippo had been your Cineplex stereotype frito bandito Mexican cowboy in an embroidered black shirt and bright green lizard skin boots, it might have been a simple choice. But Filippo wears a tailored gray sports coat over a white button-down shirt, an expensive pair of jeans and black loafers. Slightly tinted bifocals, short-cut black hair with flecks of silver. Very understated, muted, soft-spoken. Not a trace of threat in his voice or smirk on his face. Just business. An exchange of value for value. Money for freedom. A lot of things go through Dennis's mind in a hurry. Things that just the day before probably wouldn't have occurred to him, like 550K is granite countertops, is his kid's education, is fuck the coupons. He thinks about his pension down the road, how maybe it buys an RV that you stencil some name like Buccaneer on and drive across the country every other year. 550K invested wisely over those years buys you a place in Costa Rica, on the water, trips to Tuscany, granite countertops. It would be just this once, he thinks, one time and one time only, and never again. Except Dennis knows that's not true, even as he's telling it to himself. He knows that a soul isn't for rent, only for sale. But to save face, he says, "This doesn't change anything." Filippo nods, but allows just the suggestion of a smile to show on his face, because they both know this changes everything. The river of time is tough that way. Sometimes the current is so strong that you can never go back to who you used to be, even for a visit. But Dennis just nods. Filippo goes out the door, taking a big chunk of Dennis with him. 79. Who knows if faith cracks or erodes, the river of time eating away at its banks until it just crumbles, looks sudden, isn't. 80. Chan hears the ululations of morning. Lying on his back, he feels cold air rush over him. Then nothing. Laguna Beach, 1976. 81. Doc pulls a rabbit out of a hat, except it ain't no rabbit, and it ain't no hat. Doc pulls a glassine envelope out of John's surfboard. Magic. John just got home from a surfing trip with Doc to Mexico. It wasn't Third Reef Pipeline or anything like that, but it was fine, and they had a couple of girls with them, and everyone had a good time. Except now they're unloading their gear in John's driveway in Dodge City, and Doc takes one of John's boards and busts it open, and John is like, "What the hey?" "It's the future," Doc answers. John is pissed. For one thing, it's one of his favorite boards. Two, he's 24 now, and eligible for adult felony time. If Doc wants to take crazy chances, why doesn't he do it with his own board? Except Doc is like a god to him. And now God speaks. "You think there's money in grass?" Doc says. "Grass is junior achievement. Coke is Wall Street. The hippie thing is over. Peace, love, stick it up your ass. Jimmy, dead. Janice, dead. It's sympathy for the devil now." The future is in money, and the money is in coke. Stockbrokers do coke, movie producers, music executives, doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, they do coke, not grass. Grass is a house in Dodge City, coke is a place on the beach. Grass is a new van, coke is a leased Porsche. Grass is hippie chicks and patchouli oil, coke is models and Chanel. John gets it. John goes with it. It's 1976. It's the bicentennial. 82. She stares into the mirror and slowly, meticulously, draws the eyeliner pencil under her eye. The eyeliner is perfect. The mascara is perfect. The subtle blue eyeshadow is perfect. The slight blush that highlights her porcelain cheekbones is perfect. She brushes her straight, lush blonde hair to a perfect shine. Coldly, objectively, critically, Kim decides that she is perfect. Getting up from the stool, she steps over to the full-length mirror attached to the door of her tiny room in the double-wide down in the flats of San Juan Capistrano near the strawberry fields. Kim straightens the classic little black dress and checks that it shows enough, but not too much, thigh, and enough, but not too much, cleavage. The dress represents months of waiting tables at the Harbor Grill in Dana Point for shitty tips and sidelong glances because Kim is a looker who doesn't look 17. She decides that the dress is perfect. So is the black bra that pushes her breasts into the perfect globes she sees in Vogue, Cosmo, and even Playboy, which she studies to discover what men think a woman should be, and Penthouse to learn what men think a woman should do. Kim doesn't otherwise know, because she's never had a boyfriend, never gone out on a date. She isn't going to get into the back seat. She isn't even going to get into the car. She is Kim the Ice Maiden, Kim the Frigidaire, and she doesn't care what they say about her. She isn't going to waste herself on high school boys who can't do anything to make her life better or give her what she wants, which is something better, much better, than the series of crappy apartments and mobile homes that her mother has worked her ass off to provide. Better than the series of bedmates that her mother brings home and urges to leave early before her daughter wakes up. Kim has been saving herself, keeping herself to herself, watching, watching, waiting, waiting for her body to grow into her soul, for it to be perfect and perfectly irresistible, because you use what you have. The world didn't give her money, or family, or position, but it gave her beauty. And now she sees that she's ready to go looking, hunting, really, for a better life. Kim has a plan. 83. She's been working on it for months. Okay, all her life. But this particular plan came to her months ago as she scanned the social pages